Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. Stories of the West, from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Adele, reading Delilah of the Snows by Harold Binlong. Chapter 27, The Blockade. The moon was high above the white peaks, and a stinging frost was in the air, when Ingleby and Ledger sat a little apart from a snapping fire behind a great redwood trunk that had been felled across the trail and the constricted entrance to the canyon. It was wide of girth, and lay supported on the stumps of several splintered branches, breast high above the soil, with the rest of its spreading limbs piled about it in tremendous ruin. On the side where the fire was, some of them had been hewn away, and a handful of men lounged smoking in the hollow between them and the trunk. Another man stood upon the tree, apparently looking down the valley, with his figure cutting blackly against the blueness of the night. Sewell leaned against a shattered branch a few feet away from Ingleby, gazing about him reflectively. He noticed that the great butt of the fir was jammed against the slope of rock that ran up overhead, too steep almost for the snow to rest upon it, and that the top of the tree was in the river, some 20 yards away. The stream frothed and roared about it in a wild white rapid, though long spears of crackling ice stretched out behind the boulders, and there was a tremendous wall of rock on the farther side. It was absolutely unscalable, and from the crest of its ranks of clinging pines rolled backwards up a slope that was almost as steep. It was evident that nobody coming from the police outpost or the commissioner's dwelling could approach the fallen tree except by the trail in front, and on that side the branches formed an entanglement an agile man would have some difficulty in scrambling through, even if nobody desired to prevent him, while two or three of the men beside the fire had rifles with them. The rest had axes. Sewell, who noticed all this, glanced towards them thoughtfully. He could not see their faces, but their silence had a significance, and there was a vague suggestion of resolution in their attitudes. Most of them were men of singularly unyielding temperament, who had grappled with hard rock and primeval forest from their youth up. "It is a tolerably strong position, and it's the strength of it that particularly pleases me," he said. "If there were any prospect of his getting in, Esmond would no doubt try it. As it is, he will probably find it advisable to stop outside and compromise." "I'm glad you're satisfied," said Ledger. "Still, it's a little unfortunate you were not here this morning. In that case, we might have found some other means of getting over the difficulty, though I'm not sure that there was any." Ingleby glanced sharply at Ledger. His face was clear in the moonlight, and it was expressionless, but his tone had been suggestively dry, and for just a moment, an unpleasant fancy flashed upon Ingleby. It was certainly unfortunate that Sewell, whom everybody looked to for guidance, had been away that day, and the fact might have had significance for anyone who doubted him. Ingleby, however, had unshaken confidence in the man and thrust the thought from him. Sewell smiled as he turned to Ledger. "I was looking for a deer," he said. "Anyway, you had Ingleby." "Ingleby," said Ledger, "is usually where he's wanted. Some men have that habit. It's a useful one, though I'm afraid I haven't acquired it. In fact, I fancy I'm rather like Trooper Probyn. He was addicted to turning up just when it would have been better for everybody if he had stayed away." He turned from them somewhat abruptly and strolled towards the men about the fire, while Sewell looked thoughtful as he filled his pipe. "Ledger doesn't appear to be in a particularly pleasant mood, but he's right in one respect," he said. "It would have been a good deal better if he and Hetty had been anywhere else when Esmond turned up at the bakery. Of course, they couldn't help it, but the result of it is going to be serious. It is not exactly convenient that the thing should have happened now." Ingleby made a gesture of comprehension as he glanced towards the men about the fire. Their big axes gleamed suggestively, and the rifle of the man upon the tree twinkled coldly when the moonlight rested on the line of barrel. "It's all of it unfortunate," he said deprecatingly. "I suppose I'm responsible, but I don't quite see what else anybody could have expected me to do. I couldn't leave Hetty in Esmond's hands. It was out of the question. The police wouldn't have much difficulty in making her out an accessory." Sewell smiled. "That was all that concerned you?" "Yes," said Ingleby, "I think so. I don't seem to remember anything else. Anyway, it was sufficient." He made a little forceful gesture which suggested even more plainly than what he said that the thought of leaving Hetty exposed to any peril was intolerable. "And you inconsequently decided to put up a bluff of this kind on the British nation because Esmond might involve in difficulties a girl with whom you are not in love? I'm presuming you are not in love with her." Ingleby seemed a trifle disconcerted. "No," he said sharply, "of course I'm not. What made you suggest it?" Sewell laughed. "Well," he said, "for one thing, if you had been in love with her, you could scarcely have done anything that would have made the fact clearer." There was silence for a minute or two, and Ingleby leaned upon the tree with his thoughts in confusion. He was not in love with Hetty Ledger, but it was certainly a fact that her arrest had filled him with an almost unaccountable consternation. He also remembered the curious little laugh with which she had clung to him, and that it had stirred him as no trifling favor Grace Colthurst had ever shown him had done. The commissioner's daughter had, however, certainly never leaned upon his shoulder with her arms about him, though he had, on one occasion, when she was half frozen, practically carried her into her father's dwelling. The thought of it was, in a curious fashion, almost distasteful, as well as preposterous. His regard for her was largely that of a devotee, an aesthetic respect which would have made any display of purely human proclivities on the part of the goddess a trifle disconcerting. There are men like Ingleby, whose life is, partly from inclination, and partly from force of circumstances, in some respects, one of puritanical simplicity, especially in the back blocks of England's colonies. And startled by Sewell's suggestion, he tried to reason with himself as he leaned against the tree. He remembered now how he had thrilled to the girl's touch, as half crying and half laughing she had rested in his arms a few hours ago. And he could not admit the almost unpleasant explanation that this was because they were man and woman. Still, he had felt her heart beating upon his breast, and something in his nature had, it seemed to him, awakened and throbbed in response to it. It was, he felt, not sensual passion, it was not love, since it was Grace Colthurst he loved, and his confusion grew more confounded as he vainly strove to classify it. Ingleby, as one who did the obvious thing, and was usually doing something, unless he was asleep, had seldom been led into any attempt to unravel the complexities of human thought and emotion. Men of his temperament are, as a rule, too busy for anything of the kind. It is material facts that interest them, and their achievements are usually apparent and substantial, written in that country on hard rock and forest, or on the orchards and wheat fields that smile where the wilderness had been. "Well," said Sewell at length. Ingleby made a little gesture. The thing is done. Why I did it doesn't, after all, greatly matter. We have the results of it to face just now. Precisely, that's why I'm pleased you chose a very convenient spot to chop the tree in. There's one of them becoming apparent already. He pointed across the fallen log, and the man who stood upon it made a little sign. The tree was in the shadow, but beyond it lay a narrow strip of moonlit snow, upon which the dusky pines closed in again. A man moved out into the strip, walking cautiously and carrying a carbine. He stopped abruptly, dropping the butt of it with a little thud, and turning his head, he apparently glanced at somebody behind him. "They've chopped a big tree right across the trail," he said. His voice rang clearly through the nipping air, and Ingleby almost envied him as he stood unconcernedly still, a dusky, motionless object, with a blacker shadow projected in front of him on the gleaming snow. He, at least, had no responsibility, and was there to do what he was bidden, while the law would hold him guiltless. The brief and decisive attempt on the outpost had scarcely given Ingleby cause for thought, but it was different now. There was nothing exhilarating in standing still and wondering what course the police would take, while other men have felt misgivings when brought face to face with constituted authority with arms in its hand. Sewell, in the meanwhile, moved quietly towards the fire. "You will leave this thing to me, boys," he said. "Above all, keep your hands off those rifles. It's a bluff we're putting up." By this time, several other men had moved out upon the strip of snow, and one who came up from behind walked past them and stopped not far from the tree. Ingleby could see his face in the moonlight and recognized him as Esmond. He looked up at the man who, though he had handed his rifle to a comrade, still stood upon the log, regarding him quietly. "Well," he said, "what are you doing there?" "Seeing that nobody gets over," was the uncompromising answer. Esmond laughed as though he had partly expected this. "There are no doubt more of you behind there. If you have one, I would prefer to talk to your recognized leader." Sewell sprang up upon the tree. "I think I can venture to claim my comrade's confidence," he said. "In any case, I am quite willing to accept the responsibility for anything that has been done." "You may be asked to remember that," said Esmond dryly. "Do you mind explaining why you felled this tree?" "I think the man who answered you already made that clear, to prevent anybody's getting over. Once you recognize that it would be difficult to do it without our permission, we'll go a little further." "Then you are deliberately placing obstacles in the way of the police carrying out their duty. I warn you that it may turn out a serious matter." Sewell laughed. "I'm not sure the question is a very happy one. It is rather too suggestive of Monday morning in England. Still, I suppose what we mean to do amounts to that, although we will have pleasure in permitting you to enter the valley when you wish, on one or two perfectly reasonable conditions." "It remains to be seen whether you can keep us out." Esmond raised his voice a trifle. "Climb up on that log, Troopergreave, and let me know who Prospector Sewell has with him," he said. "You have authority to fire on anybody who tries to prevent you." It seemed to Ingleby that Esmond had displayed a good deal of tact. He was aware that in an affair of the kind, the right start counts for a good deal, and that if the miners permitted the trooper to survey their position, it might lead to an unwished-for change in their attitude. If they did not, it would make them the aggressors. And there was the further difficulty that they would probably shrink from offering violence to a single man. "The trooper must not be hurt, boys, but he must not get up on the log," he said, and turned to Sewell with a little gesture of deprecation. Sewell nodded. "You're right, if we can manage it," he said. In the meanwhile, the young trooper was walking towards the barrier. Ingleby surmised that he had no great liking for his task. But beyond the fact that he was holding himself unusually straight and looking steadfastly in front of him, he showed no sign of it. The moonlight was on his face, and it was almost expressionless. "Stop right where you are," said one of the miners sharply. "I guess you'd better." The trooper did not stop, nor did he answer. If he had his misgivings as a human being, he was also a part of a great system by which his nation's work is done and its prestige maintained, and he went on with stiff, measured strides, which suggested the movements of an automaton. A handful of men behind the log and another handful standing in the moonlight on the gleaming snow stood silently watching him, and most of them felt an almost unpleasant sense of tension. Then he came to the branches and stopped a moment, as though uncertain what to do. His carbine presented the difficulty, since to scramble over that tangle of branches and twigs, both hands would be necessary. Then he slung it behind him, and everyone could hear the sharp snap of the clip hook through the bitter air. After that, there was a crash as he plunged into a maze of dusky needles, and he was gasping when he emerged again. He was, however, still coming on, crawling over branches, swinging himself under some of them, while two miners waited for him intent and strung up behind the log. When he reached it, the top of the bark was almost level with his head, and throwing an arm upon it, he essayed to draw himself up. At the same moment, two pairs of sinewy hands seized his shoulders and lifted him from his feet. Then there was a shout and a swing, and he was hurled backwards like a stone. He broke through the shadowy needles amidst a crash of snapped-off twigs, and there was a confused floundering in the darkness below. Then a head rose out of it, and the trooper stood straight in the moonlight upon the fork of a great limb, looking back towards his officer now. "Am I to try again, sir?" he asked. There was a burst of approving laughter from the miners, and the trooper sprang down from the branch and moved towards his comrades when Esmond made a sign, while a man who had been speaking apart with the latter suddenly stepped forward. "It's the major," said one of the miners. "Give him a show. Come right along, sir. Nobody's going to hurt you." Colthurst made a little gesture with a lifted hand, and his remarks were brief. "You'll gain nothing by making fools of yourselves, my men," he said. "The law is a good deal too strong for you. Now try to tell me sensibly what is worrying you, and if it comes within my business, I'll see what I can do." Sewell stood up on the log and took off his big shapeless hat. There was silence for a moment while the major looked at him. "Mr. Sewell," he said gravely, "I'm sorry to see you here." "I'm a little sorry myself, sir," said Sewell. "Still, that's not quite the point, and if you will listen for a minute or two, I will try to make our views clear. They are not really unreasonable. In the first place, we want Tomlinson tried here by his peers, which, although a little unusual, could, I think, be done. If Captain Esmond can prove him guilty, we will give him up, and he can get a regular court to confirm the verdict. Then we ask immunity for the men who held up the outpost and one or two trifling modifications of the mining regulations, which are probably within the discretion afforded you by your commission." "It seems to me," said Colthurst dryly, "that you are asking a good deal, more, in fact, than you are likely to get. Do you insist on all that?"
"We feel compelled to do so, sir."
Colthurst made a little sign and moved back to where Esmond stood. They conferred together, and the major spoke again. "Captain Esmond is willing to promise that if you go home straight away, no proceedings will be taken against any man for his share in this night's work. He will promise you nothing further, and I may say that in this I quite concur with him. I must warn you that what you are doing is a very serious thing."
"Then," said Sewell quietly, "there is nothing more to be said.
We have strength enough effectively to prevent Captain Osmond from going any further up the valley. It would be better for everybody if he did not compel us to make use of it." Osmond, who had been unusually patient hitherto, apparently lost his self-command. "We will endeavor to whip the insolence out of you," he said. "By the time the thing is settled, your leaders will be exceptionally sorry for themselves." He drew back a little with the major, and they appeared to be talking earnestly for a space. It seemed to Ingleby that Osmond wished to chance an attack, but perhaps the troopers were worn out, or the major recognized the strength of the miner's position. For at last he made a little sign, and the men moved back silently into the shadow of the pines. Then the tension slackened, and Ingleby shivered a little as he strove towards the fire. "Oh, it's horribly cold, though I never felt it until a minute or two ago," he said. "Well, I suppose we are in for it now." Sewell laughed in a curious fashion. "I almost think so. Captain Osmond is not a very imposing personage in himself, but he stands for a good deal, you see. Still, it's tolerably evident that he will not trouble us any more tonight." A few minutes later, another miner climbed up on the log and the rest lay down, rolled in their blankets, about the crackling fire. Join me next time on the Sagebrush Trail for more Western adventure in Delilah of the Snows by Harold Benlos.